Say, it's very good to see each and every one of you. Glad that you're here and able to be here. And I mentioned on Wednesday night during our Bible study, I was bringing up a few things during it about a set of lessons that I want to do. And one of the points I made, though, was definitely don't plan on them being once a week. Even if you like it, it just can't happen. They take a little too much time to be every week. They'll have to spread out, every few weeks to be able to do them justice. But what I was looking to do is really life for New Testament Christians. As I was working through that last little series that we were doing on the life of Jesus, a lot of different things that I was researching and looking at was making points about, what the individuals dealt with during that time. And I made a few notes as I went through, and I've done a lot of studying, on it since. So this morning, the group that I want to look at this morning is Israel. Talking about the area of Palestine, this would be like Judea, Samaria, Galilee, right in that area in particular is the group I'm looking at. And I've got my sights set on, talking about, what Christians, the life for New Testament Christians in Rome. That's a big one. Paul wrote a whole letter to the Romans, wanting to take and go and be with them and speak and teach with them. So, with that, alone, I'd like to look at that group. Corinth is another one. Paul wrote two, complete letters to Corinth and a lot that they dealt with. And then some of the others, we'll see as we go. But this one in particular, I think, will help us now, even with our Bible class material that we're looking at on Wednesday night. So really what I've done with Israel here is I want to look at from the time an individual would be born all the way up through just the general life of, someone within this area. And it would actually let us understand more along the lines of when it comes to the time of, say, Acts 2, when the lessons were being preached, people started converting, and then what it would still be like, in that area. But particularly with the Gospels and what it was like when Christ was walking among them and why things may have not been accepted the way they were, or why Jesus taught and spoke on things the way that he did, or even incidents that happened during this time. So let us begin. And I think I've got all my verses on the screen this morning, but definitely feel free to turn and find them and double check me on these. But let's start with birth. A huge thing with Christmas and the birth of Christ and swaddling cloth and that kind of thing. So sort of interesting at the same time frame I'm doing this, but in Israel as a whole, Palestine area, Galilee, Judea, different ones, there was really only a 50% chance of survival when you were born. 50% chance. That's rough. I mean, half and half that you're going to make it. 50% chance. So survival rate, super low. You were birthed by a midwife. Fellas, we were nowhere to be found. If we lived in that time, nowhere to be found whatsoever. You were out. You were gone working, whatever, out worrying about it, but you were not there as your child was being born. So definitely worrying on the outside, 50% chance of survival, and you've got nothing to do with. You're no help. That's just how it was. This was a really interesting point to me, but once a child was born, they're surviving this birth, they were taken and rubbed down with salt. It's sort of like curing a ham. That's the first thought of my mind. I'm like, That doesn't sound the best option for a child. Completely salt them up and wrap them, real tight. To me, that's what you do when you salt a ham. You dip it and you roll it up in salt and you wrap it tight and you let it cure. But that's the first thing that they did with the child. So the ideal of even like Christ, Luke 2:12, and this shall be a sign unto you, shall find the babe wrapped in swaddling cloths, lying in a manger. So it's not that the swaddling cloth is anything in particular. They wrapped every child that way. When the child was born, they rubbed them down with salt and they wrapped them tight. And that's how they left them. And I'm guessing, you know, part of that might be bacteria and different things at the 50%, you know, survival rate. Maybe the salt, you know, it is an effective way of killing things off, you know, to keep a child from catching things and dying. I'm not fully sure about that. But the survival rate is low. So if you survived birth to start growing up, it was an amazing thing. Half and half, 50-50. Now the home. The home that the general individual was raised in, the walls were usually stone, coated in mud, and like the picture I've got, this would be a lime washed, you know, whitewashed, they call it like a whitewash wall, you know, and they would do the sepulchers and the tombs that way. He talked about Matthew 23, how they were whitewashed, you know, the ideal of taking lime and painting it with that lime wash, and it'd be bright white. You know, so this picture of this home here that's betrayed has been lime washed over the mud. The roofs were beams, and you can see the beams that are sticking out, you know, on the sides there. And then they would take branches, you know, or smaller trees, little limbs and stuff, and they would lay them in order across those beams. And then they would pack that with mud and let it harden. A lot of roofs were walked on. You can even see like this here coming up. You go back, you know, into like Samuel's time, read King David up on the roof, and he looked down and saw Bathsheba bathing, you know, behind her house in that sense. A lot of times they would take and try to put like skins or something up here so that the wind could still blow through and it would block the sun. And a lot of times people would stay on top of those roofs. But that was a standard home. I mean, we're talking about stone and mud. I mean, just mud that's dry, sort of like masonry in a sense. Mark 2:4, you know, an example of you know, this kind of layout. It says, when they could not come nigh unto him for the press, the amount of people around the house, they uncovered the roof where he was. And when they had broken it up, they let down the bed wherein the sick of the palsy lay. So they climbed up on the roof. They started popping the mud and stuff off enough that they could move the branches and all and lowered him down in. So that's the standard home. Now with that, thinking about that kind of home, we want to think family. Like what kind of family, you know, would be there? Like, you know, the group dynamic of a family. Pretty much everything that I found really matches with Ephesians 5. You know, what Paul is talking to the Ephesians, the kind of household that we would have. So bear with me. I've got a couple slides here to look at. But Ephesians 5, beginning at verse 22. Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, as the church is subject unto Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. Ephesians 6, beginning at 1. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor thy father and mother, which is the first commandment, with promise, that it may be well with thee, and thou mayest live long on the earth. And ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Verse 5. Servants, be obedient to them that are your master according to the flesh, with fear and trembling, and singleness of your heart, as unto Christ. Not with eye service as men pleasers, but as the servants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, with good will doing service as to the Lord and not to men. So family dynamic. You would have the husband and the wife. So with that, you've got the husband that's the head of the household. He's making the decisions for the household. And we're going to talk further about that in a moment. You've got the wife. She is in submission to her husband. In most cases, she does not own land. She does not make the decisions on buying and selling different things. But she is in control of running the household. That is her place. She takes care of the house. You know, so when you talk about covering the, you know, taking care of the household in that sense, that everyday running of the house, the food, the everything, buying it, that's her realm. Now, the husband takes care of all the money, protection, and everything else, and makes those decisions for that. Now, the standard house would usually have his parents as well. And we're going to talk a little bit about passing on of the trade or the land or so forth, but his parents would usually still be in that household. with the same. They may have young children that they've just had, or as the children have grown older, also the sons would marry, and their daughters-in-law, you know, the sons that married these ladies, they all move into the same house. So just with that, you've got the head of the house, his wife, his grandparents, their children, maybe young children and married children, daughters-in-law that have moved in. Any daughters would marry and move away. Then also, if you wondered why I read with the Ephesians and wondered why that's connected, why, you know, it talks about husbands, wives, children, and servants. You know, I've never really thought about it till I've done this lesson, but why servants put there with this whole family dynamic? Because they stayed right in the same house as well. They all were there. That's all part of the household. The servants that they had were right in the household as well. And also, it was very common for strangers, anybody that was coming through, for you to just take in and take care of. And you're thinking, okay, well, where would you pull strangers from? Well, think about this in Exodus 20 and verse 10. Talking, you know, the Lord talking about those that would keep the Sabbath. Now, remember the Sabbath, you know, Saturday and no work and different things. And the amount of, you could travel and everything. Remember, there's a lot of stipulations on what could be done on that day. Look at Exodus 20 and verse 10. But the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou, nor thy son, nor thy daughter, thy manservant, thy maidservant, nor thy cattle, nor thy stranger that is within thy gates. It was just a common practice. Anybody that was traveling through that may need a place to stay at night, you took them in and you provided for them. You just did that. So within that house, like you would grow up in that house, you would have the grandparents, you'd have the parents, you would have older siblings possibly, unless you were the oldest and you were learning, you know, but you would have all of that. Then you had servants that stayed there. You had strangers it might be a every other day or every day thing, people coming through. That was what you was used to. And they all stayed within that household. That's what you grew up with. Now back to the man. Again, the man, he took care of providing for them all. That was the ideal of, you know, like governing top things, anything that dealt with legal, law, land. You know, the man took care of all of that, the money and all of the different things. So when we get a passage like James 1:27, this makes even better sense. You know, James says, pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this, to visit the fatherless and widows in their affliction and to keep himself unspotted from the world. In this time frame, in particular, they were the absolute most vulnerable individuals. There was no head male to take care of those. They were fatherless. They did not have the father to take care and rule the household and make sure that they were watched over and provided for. The widow had lost that. And if she has no sons or anybody else take care of her, she really has nothing. No means to do anything, no buying, no selling. I mean, she has nothing. There is no governmental programs. There's nothing of that nature. Those two individuals without the male, if the male was lost, they were out of luck. So that's why, you know, James writing to members of the church, you know, talking about a good Christian individual, they would make sure those individuals were taken care of. Why? Because they were the absolute most vulnerable. There was no other way to take care of them. Within that family situation, the son would automatically take on the father's trade. That's just what was expected. A good example of this is with the same account here, Matthew's account and Mark's account. Matthew 13:55 says, talking about Jesus and his family dynamic, is not this the carpenter's son? All right, is not his mother called Mary and his brethren James and Joseph, Simon and Judas? Now, Mark 6:3's account, is not this the carpenter? Jesus had learned the father's trade. Is this not the carpenter? You know, he didn't start his, you know, preaching until he's 30. He learned his father's trade. All right, so here you see this is the carpenter's son. He's also the carpenter, Mark's account. The son of Mary, the brother of James and Joseph and of Judah and Simon, And are not his sisters here with us? And they were offended at him. Because here he is preaching and teaching to them as a learned individual. And they're like, isn't he the carpenter? One thing that I learned on this as well. A carpenter actually was one of the most poorest. They did, you know, when we think carpenter today, the word used for carpenter, we think of someone that just does like woodworking in a sense. But the carpenter really did like brick, block, you know, all the things like on the homes. The problem is a lot of people did that on their own. They didn't need a carpenter. So the carpenter might be in a little bit of a bigger area like Nazareth, like closer to town, and take care of things maybe for more of the wealthy that wouldn't take and do those things on their own and got paid pretty little for it. So the carpenter, you know, when they're pointing out, isn't this the carpenter or this is the carpenter's son, it's sort of a disrespectful thing, downgrading. You know, this is a lowly individual as well. So keep that in mind. The sons would also inherit the land that would pass forward, or, you know, say, we're going to talk about it, the tenant farmer, like the contract with those of more money, they would get passed down with that. The eldest always got a double portion. That was just how it was. We're going to look at a verse for that. The eldest got a double portion. The other sons would get a portion. And really the girls, they only would, you know, gain land or something of that nature that would then transfer to their husband if there were no sons whatsoever. You know, the girls, they married, they moved to their husband's family and so forth. Some verses to show this. Deuteronomy 21 and verse 17. But he shall acknowledge the son of the hated for the firstborn, and I'll give you some background on this in a minute, by giving him a double portion of all that he hath, for he is the beginning of his strength, the right of the firstborn is his. Numbers 27 and 8. And thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel, saying, if a man die and have no son, then ye shall cause his inheritance to pass unto his daughter. The background on Deuteronomy 21:17. A situation has come up where a man had two wives. He really didn't love the first one, even though the first wife had the oldest son, but he really loved the younger, and the whole idea was wanting to pass, you know, the majority on to that son. And the law, you know, being brought up says no. Even the hated wife, her son was the firstborn. He gets the double portion. You know, so that there's the law in place. This is the Old Testament law. This is what they live by. And historically, it can be, you know, accounted as being such. Occupation-wise, you know, like work, you know, what did the majority work at? You know, there's Jesus with being a carpenter. But the majority were farmers / shepherds, you know, on the land, using the land. They got up early. I was reading quite a few things on it. They rose up very early and went out without anything. You didn't eat anything. You get everything started on the farm. Once you got sort of things fairly started, sometimes they could come back in. They might get a little bite. If not, they just take and wait till, you know, noonday hour to get a little bit something at that time. But it was always very early in the morning, got up and got things rolling. They usually wore robes of wool or a linen. Now, there's a difference in the scriptures. You can see where it says linen and fine linen. Linen is, you know, the same material, maybe not as good a quality and not worked down as fine and as good filling as the fine linen is. The rich wear the fine linen. The normal person could have linen, and that's if someone maybe knew how to do it there and would put the time and effort into it. Their meals were mainly of vegetables and bread. And I was reading in one spot, they said that 70% of all the calories that an individual, the normal individual, would eat was from bread. That even the vegetables take care of everything else. And you're thinking, well, they got all this these shepherds and the flock, and why aren't they eating all those? We'll get to that. You know, and even the vegetables, you know, and stuff, you fed the flock. And there's another reason as well why there wasn't many vegetables. But this ought to bring in perspective in Jesus' prayer, when he's giving them the example prayer, Matthew 6:11, give us this day our daily bread. That's what they lived off of. That was it. You know, I mean, that that's what they had to have. 70% of what they survived on any one day is their daily bread. As well, whatever bread they got was received that day. So if they did not make anything, they didn't buy anything. If they wasn't able to go in and buy the bread, they really didn't have the bread. So the daily bread, give us this day our daily bread. That's really what they're praying for. You know, dear Lord, please let us have what it takes to have bread for this day alone. Being thankful for being able to have just the bread for that single day. So that's why it's part of that prayer. Think about that. In the long run, the majority of people would be what we classify as extremely poor. So that brings me to status. There's a huge divide in status. There's the elite, and then there's everyone else, the extremely poor. And I mean, there's that huge divide. There was really no middle class, period. I mean, it just wouldn't happen. It was not allowed. There was just nothing in the middle. So when you see like the Pharisees come, they rebuke Jesus about eating with certain individuals, him supposedly in their mind being some great prophet or something, not accepting him as the Messiah, they saw it as him, you know, putting himself with people that he really shouldn't have been with. He should have been closer to their elite status instead of down with the poor. They look down on them. They look, you know, like turn their nose up to them. And then they're like, why would you put yourself with those kind of individuals? There was no middle class. You were either part of the elite or you're part of the extremely poor. You really had little to nothing. Jesus speaks on this kind of eliteness. Mark 10 and verse 25. It is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of God. Talking about when he would die, the kingdom, you know, the church would start. That if they had this same mindset that they have at this time, the elite, all right, it would be easier to put a camel through an eye of a needle, or if they're talking about that little gap in the wall, if Jerusalem called the eye of a needle, it would be easier for a camel to go through that than for a rich man to be able to be a faithful child of God. Because of their whole idea of who they were and shunning everyone else. Luke 6:24, but woe unto you that are rich, for ye have received your consolation. As you're already sitting up fine and dandy, and you're feeling good, you're living it up. And that's really the way they were. They were living it up. We're going to talk about that a little more coming up. Now, there was a mixture of these in the church, and we can see this in Acts 4. You know, so you can still see that there was an elite and the poor, but their mindset's different. The elite, money-wise, had, you know, some of these were those that would have been like the camel through the eye of the needle. Acts 4, beginning at 32, says, and the multitude of them that believed were of one heart and of one soul. Neither said any of them that aught of the things which he possessed was his own, but they had all things common. And with great power gave the apostles witness of the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and great grace was upon them all. Neither was there any among them that lacked, for as many as were possessors of lands or houses sold them and brought the prices of the things that were sold and laid them down at the apostles' feet, and distribution was made unto every man according as he had need. And Joseph, who by the apostles was surnamed Barnabas, which is being interpreted the son of consolation, a Levite, so, you know, a priest, and of the country of Cyprus, having land, sold it and brought the money and laid it at the apostles' feet. So, you know, the whole idea would be easier to go through than a rich man. Well, there were some of those that were elite that believed, that obeyed the gospel. And they saw the need of the extremely poor that also had believed and obeyed and had nothing. And they sold what they had and took care of them. Let's talk in general about the towns. Now, the towns would be the bigger area, sort of like Nazareth, maybe where Jesus himself, you know, where he was a carpenter there. Within the standard, you know, little town, there's a synagogue. Now, the synagogue really was about the center of everything. Religious functions of all natures, the reading on the Sabbath. It was a central meeting place. It was a local school where the law could be taught. Also a seat of government. There would be a marketplace where you could come and buy and sell, a communal well. And then another aspect of all these little towns was, it was called Agora. the town square. And this is important for the one reason in particular. The town square was set up for day laborers to gather to be hired. These would be individuals that really did not have the land. They were not tenant farmers, we're going to talk about. But they would take and just come and wait in this area. It was just, this area was cut out for that purpose to be hired. Matthew 20, 1 and 2, just a piece of this, you know, this parable. For the kingdom of heaven is likened to a man that is a householder, which went out early in the morning to hire laborers into his vineyard. And when he had agreed with the laborers for a penny a day, he sent them into his vineyard. So this is what he would have done. He would have come to the agora, and he would have picked out a few and said, all right, I'm willing to pay a penny a day. Who wants to come work? All right, you, all right, let's go. And then he would take them home. Now, the rest of the parable is he comes back two more times because the work's not getting done enough, and he hires more on. But we can understand why the use of this parable now, right? The ideal of coming to the agora, the town square, where these individuals are waiting to be hired, and the man with the land is hiring these day laborers to come work for him. So it's a day-to-day thing. Everybody understood this. This was part of their life. So when Jesus brings up this parable with a heavenly meaning, it's something they would understand. They may have stood there and waited all day to be hired and nobody come to get them. But let's talk government. In particular, definitely they're all under Roman rule. Rome has conquered, you know, they pushed out the rest of the Greeks and so forth. Now, Palestine in particular was not really that great of an importance to Rome except for one major thing. It was a passageway. All right, Palestine, that whole area right there, it really didn't have anything to mine of its own that was of any value. There just wasn't a lot of great value there. It was great for farming, great for, you know, raising herds. But they needed it to go from some of their land they had above Syria and others down through to Egypt and other places. So one of the biggest things is passageway. So all they really needed was just keep the peace so things could be transported through them. So at the beginning of the Gospels, we start with Herod the Great. Herod the Great had been placed over this region. The Jews really were left to rule themselves as long as they remained peaceful. You know, as long as you just do as you're told, we'll let you continue to rule over yourself. And that really did stay in place, you know, the majority of it. And there was little to no occupied troops during his reign of 37 B.C. through 4 B.C. The troops really just were not there. The Romans, they would pass through with troops and go. You know, that's the whole idea of Jesus saying, if they compel you to go a mile, you know, pack their stuff a mile, go too. You know, they usually just traveled through. Peace, quiet, everything was there. Now, at his death, though, this area that was all his was divided to his sons. Philip was over Syria, up at the top. And then Herod Antipas, he took Galilee, and he was given the title of Tetrarch. You know, instead of really king over the whole area, he was given Tetrarch. Luke 23:6, when Pilate heard of Galilee, he asked whether the man were a Galilean. And as soon as he knew that he belonged unto Herod's jurisdiction, Antipas, he sent him to Herod, who himself also was at Jerusalem at that time. Now, Judea, which is where Jerusalem would be, as well as Samaria just above it, was Herod Archelaus, and he was given the title Ethnarch, E-T-H-N-A-R-C-H. Matthew 2:22 says, and when he had heard that Archelaus did reign in Judea in the room of his father Herod, he was afraid to go thither, notwithstanding being warned of God in a dream, he turned aside into the parts of Galilee. Talking about when they come back from Egypt, bringing Jesus back home. You know, here's Archelaus that was there in that area. Now, he was removed in AD 6. Governors at that time were placed by the Roman Empire, and they actually were placed with troops. There were some issues that come up during this time, and I'm actually going to bring up a slide about that. So, you know, the Roman government just wasn't happy with how it was being ruled. So, okay, you're removed. We're going to put in somebody with a little more power, and we're going to send troops with them. One of those individuals was Pontius Pilate that we read about in the New Testament, and he kept about 3,000 or so troops with him in this area. Usually they all stayed in the cities like Caesarea, the bigger, more Roman top towns. And they only came to Jerusalem during the three feast days, just like we saw, Herod. He came to Jerusalem during his time. Pilate is there during the time, Jesus being judged. They're there really to keep the peace. They come back and they've got more troops with them because, it could be 1 million, 2 million Jews there at one time. Here's a verse, it says, "Now when Festus was coming to the province, after 3 days he ascended from Caesarea to Jerusalem." Acts 25:1, showing that, that's where they most of us stay, and they went down to Jerusalem. But that also lets you really understand when Jesus is there being judged, why are they all there? Why is Pilate there? Why is Herod there? Would they always be there? And the answer is no. They're not usually there. The day-to-day rule was really left to the high priest, and assisted by the Sanhedrin. They were given that rule. Now, they would take and bring things to the Roman government if they needed extra help or extra authority. But in the long run, it was left up to them. Acts 4:5-6 says, "And it came to pass on the morrow that their rulers and elders and scribes and Annas the high priest and Caiaphas and John and Alexander and as many as were of the kindred of the high priest were gathered together at Jerusalem." Acts 5:21 says, "And when they heard that, they entered into the temple early in the morning and taught. But the high priest came, and they that were with him, and called the council together," the Sanhedrin, "and all the senate of the children of Israel, and sent to the prison to have them brought." So, this is an elite group of individuals. The priests, the high priest, Sadducees, Pharisees, which the high priest, his family were all Sadducees, a smaller group, but had a lot of money, a lot of power because of being really the one in true power, like under Pilate. All right, so when you start thinking, like the judging of Jesus, they brought it before Caiaphas first, then they brought it before the Sanhedrin, then they had a true, judging of the Sanhedrin in the light of day. Then they took it to Pilate. Pilate sent him to Herod. Herod sent it back to Pilate. And then, he was crucified. But that lets you understand why there's the judgment here, then why they wanted to send him to Herod to get death penalty, or Pilate. And then Pilate said, "Well, Herod's here, and he's from Galilee. Let's send him to him." Then he's like, "Nah, send him back to Pilate. Let him deal with it," because it is in Jerusalem at the moment anyhow. I also want to go back to this elite divide, because this is really important. Because when we start talking about the high priest, the priest, the Sanhedrin, Pharisees, Sadducees, and all of these individuals, most all of them lived in towns, and they lived really, really well. They are the elite. Luke 16:19, "There was a certain rich man," this ideal of being one of the elite, "which was clothed in purple, fine linen, fared sumptuously every day." Then we talk about Lazarus being at the gate begging. The other side, elite, normal person. Revelation 18:16, "And saying, Alas, alas, that great city," talking about Rome, "that was clothed in fine linen and purple and scarlet and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls." This is what the elite live like. They lived in the cities, but they owned the majority of all the land. So the standard individual, like the one you would say that Jesus come from place to place and he would teach, the majority of them were what they called tenant farmers. All right, they would take and say, "Okay, you can use my land." So that meant they got to live off of it so their families could survive. But whatever they would actually come up with, whether it's the sheep, whether it's the crops that they would sell, whatever it was, really went back to the homeowner, the landowner. They were taxed upwards to 50% of everything that they made went to taxes. Now also, they also got to pay the owner something. And that means when it come to what they could live off of, there was little to live off of. So in the long run, what I found historically that was planted and grown was what we would call cash crops. It's what could make the money. Not sustainability crops, as in I raise this big old huge garden and then I feed my family, we live well, we cull the herd, we eat what we want, so we got meat on the table. No, they live there to pay money out to everything else. That's all they did. which also meant that since it's 50% taxed heavily, we got high debt. High debt meant high consequences. That's why we've got what Jesus writes or says in Matthew 18, beginning of verse 23. Therefore is the kingdom of heaven likened to a certain king, which would take account of his servants. And when he had begun to reckon, one was brought unto him which owed him 10,000 talents. But for as much as he had not to pay, his Lord commanded him to be sold, his wife and children and all that he had in payment to be made. That was just a standard way of life. That happened all the time. So when Jesus is bringing up these kind of parables and making these points, the standard individual understood it quite well. This could happen to anybody on any of these farms in any year. You know, that it just didn't go well. So, okay, fine. You didn't do well. You didn't pay your taxes. You didn't pay me. I'm going to take you and I'm going to sell you and get my money back for it for the year. With taxes being up to 50%, the Roman officials wanted to really skip the higher elite. So they usually hired more local people in the area. That's why they were really looked down on, filled with disdain about, you know, publicans and so forth, you know, these tax collectors. Because one of the things that was just told unto them was whatever you collected above the required amount, you got to keep. So a lot of dirty, underhanded, terrible things were done to the standard individual so more money could be kept. Luke 19, Zacchaeus. It says, and Zacchaeus stood and said unto the Lord, Behold, Lord, the half of my goods I give to the poor, and if I have taken anything from any man by false accusation, I restore him fourfold. So see here, you know, Zacchaeus is making the point that I don't think Zacchaeus was a crook, but he's making the point that it's just known that tax collectors are crooks. And he's saying, if anybody can show that I've done them bad, I'll give fourfold back. Four times what they show that I cheat them, I'll give them four times that back because I'm not that guy. But that was the standard of life. You know, if you had a tax collector in your area that was a crook, not only was you paying upwards to 50%, but they was probably taking even more than that for their own pockets. So again, extremely poor, a lot to deal with, a very hard life. You worked yourself to death for nothing, just to live. You worked to live that day. And hopefully you worked enough to get bread for that day. That's the life that they live. Which leads, as we're starting to close out, to really, you know, the standard individuals had certain hopes for a different life. And we could see that. I mean, we all could understand that, right? I mean, that's your day-to-day life. Get up, you know, while it's still dark. You go out, you may or may not even have anything to eat for the day. You know, if you're blessed, you might get to come in and have a chunk of bread for supper to make the next day, right? All right, they had some great hopes. There were quite a few that just hoped God would restore Israel to a state of peace, freedom, and prosperity. You know, where they could just have their own land. Originally, that's how it was. You know, even those that didn't have much, what was it, the Jubilee year. You know, everything that you know, took and like you were in debt or whatever and you put yourself, it was all restored back to you. So it was a reset. All right, give you a chance to get back on your feet, catch up. It was a reset. This wasn't happening. The elite had it. They were going to keep it. They had the backing of the Roman Empire to make sure they kept it. You know, it was just keeping the standard people under your thumb. And remember, the elite, it was the religious elite. The high priest, the priests, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, all of these individuals are the ones keeping all the other people under their thumb. They didn't want to change that. They didn't want to lose that. So, you know, when Jesus says, like Matthew 23, do as they say, but not as they do, you can understand that even better now, right? Not only just the parts of walking through the streets and wanting to say rabbi and give that praise. Why? Because they're the elite. You know, or praying out in the open and all these things. But because they treated everybody like dirt. Such a huge divide between them. Now there were a group that believed that they needed to be ready at a moment's notice to take arms for a war with Rome. And some of those actually became terrorists. And this is what I said earlier I'd bring up. You know, why there was some unrest and changing of rulers. Acts 5 verses 36 and 37. Gamaliel speaking here. Talking about, you know, Jesus and the followers, and if it was from God, you know, can't fight God, but if it's just man, then these are some examples of what happened. It says, "For before these days rose up Theudas, boasting himself to be somebody, to whom a number of men, about 400, joined themselves, who was slain. And all as many as obeyed him were scattered and brought to naught. After this man rose up Judas of Galilee in the days of the taxing, and drew away much people after him. He also perished, and all, even as many as obeyed him, were dispersed." All right? I also had a thought when I was reading through this, you know, because this is Gamaliel. He's writing this, right? And he's talking about, I think, really these terrorist-type individuals, you know, bringing off these little groups to cause trouble to the Roman Empire. But, you know, Gamaliel taught Paul, or Saul. You know, Saul sat at Gamaliel's feet and learned everything. So when Paul, later on, is talking about, does he have reason to boast? And you start thinking about the list that he started with, talking about being, you know, a Hebrew of Hebrews, as in the elite. You know, doesn't that make better sense now? You know, raised at the feet of Gamaliel, learned, you know, his dad, Pharisee, all this. What he was really putting the list is that he took, when he decided to be faithful, he went from elite status to extremely poor status. He gave up everything. Of what they thought was a good life, he gave up everything to take and teach the Word of God. Huge change in that. So when he talks about all the things that he endured, let's start with that on that list from now on. He gave up everything that people thought of as a good life to preach. And then he took the beatings and the stonings and the hunger and all that to go with it. Here's one more hope and train of thought that a lot of people had, and this was a good number. Some thought that a war would start up, you know, talking about the Messiah would come and so forth. But Michael the archangel would come down and he would destroy the majority of the Roman Empire, then God would finish them off. You know, and then we would have the new kingdom, you know, new land, the Messiah would be on the throne. And that was a big thought. Also why a lot of them was ready at a moment's notice to take arms. All right, if God's going to start this war, he's going to fight it. Michael the archangel is going to fight it. We're going to jump in and we're going to show them that we're ready to fight as well. That's how they live. That's their thoughts. That's what they were waiting on every day of their life. You know, okay, when are we going to have this physical freedom? When are we going to be able to eat besides what we might get in a day's time? You know, when are we going to get out from under this oppression? And then Christ comes. But Christ isn't fulfilling those hopes that they thought. He's not coming, and he's not changing the physical life. He's not, you know, bringing food on our table this way. He's not pushing back the Roman Empire. He's not flipping the elite upside down and restoring things like that. He's not doing any of those. He didn't meet those expectations. Now, for the standard individual that listened and learned, they understood there was something greater. But, you know, even in our Bible class, we're given Peter, James, John, and some of those a hard time, like I mentioned Wednesday night, an ideal of who's going to be the greatest. The reason that they were thinking along those lines, they had those hopes and dreams. They had the hopes and dreams of moving from that very poor to the elite type status. They were hoping that they could move out of that. You know, and if Christ was the Messiah, then that's what was going to happen. That, you know, the Roman Empire pushed out. And then that changing of being extremely poor, things would change. You know, they just don't understand that Jesus was here for their spiritual well-being, the spiritual freedom. I think that's also why there was so much resistance or just doubt. Just doubt. You know, the elite, they did not want to lose their status. They did everything possible to take and deny Christ, to deny John the Baptist. And that's really not that they didn't understand the scriptures. They didn't want to lose their elite status. They had it made. Jesus was bringing spiritual freedom, not physical freedom. And they didn't want to lose their position. After Jesus' death, peace really started deteriorating there in Judea. And it continued to get worse and worse till there was a 4-year war ending in the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. Historically, it's recorded that there were more deaths in Judea, not all of Palestine, in Judea, around Jerusalem and that area, than in our entire Civil War here in America. Just that one little chunk of land. So when you go back to like Matthew 24 and what to look for, you know, and how it says, you know, don't even worry about going back into the fields, you know, or coming from the fields, going back into the town. Yeah, the death toll was tremendous. You know, and I brought it up in lessons that, you know, the commanding officer, they had killed so many and were throwing all the bodies, you know, over into the valley of Hinnom and piling it up and the burning and the stink, that even when he come through, that he just broke down in sorrow for the amount of death that they had caused there at Jerusalem. But the Lord prophesied that that would happen because of their unbelief, because of their lack of acceptance. In conclusion, I hope, if nothing else, we get some understanding from this knowledge. Maybe with this background information, we can each understand the Gospels better. You know, the ideal of the parables. Why did Jesus use the parables that he used? Well, the standard individual, this meant something to him every day. Not just farming parables, but the farming was ideal. That's what the majority did every single day. All right, even like his prayer. Why did he pray what he prayed within the prayer? Because that's what they needed to even have bread for the day to survive. You know, why did people react the way they did to what he taught? You know, the divide among the people, you know, from the general population being afraid of the elite having the power, the authority, and then also being like spiritually in control, allowing them in the temple, not allowing them into the temple, taking the temple tax, you know, different things, you know. You know, you can understand why there's this huge divide. And, you know, maybe a little better understanding why Jesus was just not accepted. You know, he, even though all the prophecies, he fulfilled everything, the people, they were just not thinking spiritually. They were so oppressed, they were just looking for physical relief. How about for us today? I think one thing we need to get out of it is let us not be persuaded by those who govern us. Even though, you know, there was the elite compared to the standard individual, in a sense, we still have that. We have our governing bodies. And oftentimes, decisions that are made, they do affect us. You know, I think about COVID this year and shutting down worship services. Or, okay, we'll allow worship, but you ain't allowed to sing, even though singing is a command. You know, let us not be persuaded by those who govern us. You know, see the truth for what it is. Jesus came. He died for us all. So we can have the freedom for our sins. You have physical freedom, freedom in this country. We got great freedoms. We might lose those freedoms one day, but we still need to accept the freedoms from our sins, the spiritual freedoms that our Lord brought to us, and cling on to those much more dearly than our physical freedoms that we have here in this country. We have the same decision today that everyone had while Christ was there in Palestine. Accept Jesus or not. Accept him for who he is. Or not. Not changing him, not making him to be something else, but accepting him for who he was, our Savior. The one that came down and lived a sinless life and died for each of us. Where do you stand on that question today? Are you faithful or not? Today, we'd be happy to help. If you've never obeyed the gospel, to take the time and opportunity, if you know what it is, to do so, or if you have more questions on that, let me, let others here help you. We are happy to sit down and talk with you through the scriptures and show you what the Lord demands. Or maybe you obey the gospel, but you've turned back into the world. Take the time and opportunity to make that right while you have an ability to.